everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's Law School, and I'm joined once again by my friend and colleague, Mark DiGirolami, the Center's Associate Director, for an episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on issues and cases in law and religion. You can listen to past episodes on iTunes and also by going to our website, lawandreligionforum.org. That's one word, lawandreligionforum.org. Well, in our last episode on religious hate speech, we discussed state prohibitions on religious hate speech. We went through different categories of hate speech and explained that only one category is a live issue in the U.S. today, namely speech that insults or disparages individuals or groups on grounds of their perceived religious beliefs. There have been rumblings about banning such speech, but in our last episode, we saw that under current Supreme Court doctrine, state efforts to ban such speech would likely be unconstitutional under the First Amendment.
Yeah, there was one other issue that one of our colleagues and friends, Professor Nelson Tebbe, raised for us, and that is that we hadn't talked about government speech about religion in the previous episode that we did. There are separate rules for government speech. The basic gist of the idea is that government is allowed to say a lot more about religion when it's the government itself speaking, as opposed to when the government is regulating private speech. But we're going to set those issues to the side, Mark, right?
I think so. We have enough to do in this episode, even without that. So in this episode, which is part two of our series on religious hate speech, we're going to discuss efforts by private institutions to ban religious hate speech. So we're not talking about the state or public entities. We're talking about private institutions that aren't subject to the First Amendment. Now, in the interest of time, and because controversies typically arise with respect to these institutions, we're going to focus in this episode on private colleges and universities.
But we should mention that many of the things that we'll be talking about, they concern not just colleges and universities, but other sorts of private institutions, including the media, social media, the employment context, and others. But you're right, we can't possibly get to through all of that, so we're going to stick with the topic that we know best.
Right, and in fact, there have been a number of recent controversies involving private universities, private colleges that ban certain speech or that attempt to. So, for example, in March, the Trump administration issued an executive order on, quote-unquote, improving free inquiry at colleges and universities, which we'll have something to say about in this podcast. And also, there have been a lot of high-profile incidents in which private universities have disinvited speakers because of their allegedly hateful speech about religious groups. For example, last week, Middlebury College, which withdrew its invitation to the Polish academic Richard Legutko, in part because of his allegedly hateful speech about Muslims that were based in part, anyway, on his own religious commitments.
That's right, about Muslims or allegedly about LGBT matters, which were in turn based on religious commitments. So again, just as in the previous episode where we were dealing with two different categories, either hate speech based in religious commitments about various sorts of matters, sensitive matters, or on the other hand, hate speech about religious commitments. They both fall into the category of what we're talking about.
So our roadmap for this episode is as follows. First, we're going to talk about the legal right of universities to ban religious hate speech if they wish to do so. And we'll see that at the present, private institutions have a great deal of discretion in this regard. Under current doctrine, the state very probably can't interfere with these institutions' decisions about what speech and what speakers to allow. And then after we talk about the legal situation, we'll talk about the practical consequences. And we'll ask whether, even if the government stays out, we might still have a free speech problem in this country if private institutions are stopping certain kinds of speech. We'll talk here about social versus legal pressures, which is a matter that, Mark, you and I debated in a Twitter exchange with Damon Linker recently.
That's right, yeah. And that, as we'll talk about later on, isn't strictly speaking a legal matter. And so we're a little bit out of our core area of expertise, at least as to this podcast, but it is at least something important and interesting and something with which we have some experience. And it's important to talk about also the distinction between legal restrictions that are grounded in some way in the First Amendment and other sorts of cultural pressures with respect to speech more broadly.
Okay, so first let's talk about the legal landscape here. So under current doctrine, private institutions like private colleges and private universities probably have the legal right to ban speech and speakers that they consider hateful including with respect to religious hate speech. Now, we should say it's not completely clear. Court opinions in constitutional law rarely are completely clear, but there are consistent themes in the relevant case law that point to this conclusion. Any attempt by the government to prevent private institutions like colleges and universities from regulating speech on campus likely would run afoul of two separate bodies of case law. First, cases on speech and associational freedom, and then cases on unconstitutional conditions. So, Mark, let's address each of these in turns. Let's start with the so-called speech associational freedom cases.
Okay, great. So when we're dealing with the First Amendment, we've got two rights in play here, as you mentioned, the right of free speech and the right of associational freedom. Obviously, we know, most people out there know, our devoted listeners, the First Amendment includes the right of the freedom of speech. And the court has also said that the First Amendment encompasses a right to associate with other people in order to express ideas, among other sorts of reasons that one would have associations.
And these associations, Mark, are called expressive associations. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And universities are certainly a kind of expressive association. Within that kind of association. And the law here is that although the state can regulate the membership of these associations, if there's a compelling interest by, for example, forbidding discrimination against women within the group, that interest has to be unrelated to the expression of ideas.
Right. And so for our listeners, the key cases here from the Supreme Court, there's a case about the JCs. There's also a case about the Boy Scouts of America. And you look at these cases, it seems pretty clear to me, Mark, I think you'll agree with this, that if the state were to interfere with a private university's decision about what speech or speakers to allow and what speech or speakers to forbid, then that interference would almost certainly violate the university's freedom of expressive association.
Yeah, we can think of some concrete examples. Suppose a university has its roster of speakers and the government comes in and says, no, we want you to include these additional speakers A, B, and C. And it just so happened that these speakers advocate a particular position that the government would like to see advocated on campus, but that the university isn't allowing for or providing a forum for advocating. Suppose that a forum is, we could think about, pro-Trump speakers, right? Mm-hmm. You must have certain speakers on campus that are arguing for or making the case for the president as a President Trump is a good president, something like that. That would almost certainly be problematic under the First Amendment.
Right, because under these cases we've talked about, JCs and the Boy Scouts, such an action by the state would relate precisely to the university's decision about what ideas can be expressed and what can't.
Yeah, that's right. And we're talking really about two different things. We're talking about an interference with the expression of ideas as an associational matter, right? The right of the university to decide who comes in and who doesn't, who to associate with and who not. And we're also talking about the university's rights of their own rights of free speech, the rights of the university to express itself as an institutional matter.
Right. So to bring us back to our topic, if a university were to say, we are not going to allow certain speakers on campus because they have engaged in religious hate speech, again, defined as speech that disparages individuals or members of a certain religion on the basis of their perceived religious beliefs. If a university were to say, no, we're not going to allow such speakers, I don't think it would be open to the government to say, yes, you must allow these speakers on campus, assuming the government would want to do that. But I don't think it'd be possible. Now, there is one case we're going to talk about later called Thayer versus Rumsfeld, which may point in a different direction. That involved requiring law schools to allow military recruiters on campus, but we're going to talk about that later. I think probably that case wouldn't change the outcome, but we should at least flag it.
All right. And notice we're talking right now about a government regulation or an intrusion that would be specifically about demanding that certain kinds of speech be included. There may be other ways for the government to get involved, to issue regulations that aren't quite so targeted at speech or including or excluding a particular kind of speech, but essentially getting at the same kind of result that might be more acceptable.
Right. So that moves us to the next line of cases that I spoke about earlier, and that is the so-called unconstitutional conditions line of cases. So how does this work? Well, it's true, of course, that most private institutions like colleges and universities accept money from the federal government. In fact, most private colleges and universities couldn't do without money from the federal government and also from some state governments as well. They just couldn't make ends meet. And sometimes the federal government attaches strings to the money that it gives these institutions. Now, this most famously happens in the context of Title IX, so-called Title IX of the federal laws, which forbids institutions that accept federal funding from discriminating on grounds of sex. So private institutions that accept federal funds must abide by Title IX rules, which means they can't discriminate on the basis of sex according to what the federal regulations say. At the moment, the federal government, although it gives money, it doesn't require recipients of federal money to allow certain kinds of speech or speakers on campus. And frankly, I think the feds are on likely mark as a political matter to do that.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. As we said, by comparison with the previous issue, they're probably more likely to do that than they are to regulate directly. But I think it's probably true, it's probably right to say that they're unlikely to do so. Even the executive order that we were talking about, the Trump executive order, it doesn't go that far.
Let's talk about that, Mark.
Yeah. So it only encourages, well, it does a couple of things, I think. Probably more than a couple, but two for purposes of our discussion.
Right.
It encourages private colleges to comply, quote, with stated institutional policies regarding freedom of speech, close
right.
quote.
And the point of the Trump executive order was to allow free inquiry on college campuses.
That's
and
correct.
It was released to a big fanfare that now we're going to open up colleges and universities, make sure that they allow all perspectives to be heard. But as you're saying, when you actually look at what the order does, it's a lot weaker than that.
Yeah, and we should mention also this executive order. We might wonder how it came about. Well, it came about in response to some of these highly advertised and relatively high-profile events on campus of certain kinds of speakers either not being invited or being disinvited, being excluded from the forums of these colleges, ostensibly for the purposes of free inquiry.
Right. Now, so all that being said, as you were saying just a second ago, the executive order, in fact, if you look at what it does with respect to private colleges, not public colleges, private colleges, all it does is encourage private colleges to comply with their own policies regarding freedom of speech.
Well, it does that. It does something else also.
Which of course, is not saying very much, right? It's
just
saying,
true.
We encourage you to do what you say you want to do.
Exactly. No, please conform with your own policies, right? But there's something else that it does, which might augur perhaps some greater intrusion on the part of the federal government, which is that it urges departments within the executive to craft policies that are aimed at protecting speech and, quote unquote, promoting free inquiry in federally funded programs. So that we'll have to see what happens with those, how in what direction the executive and the various departments that have been delegated this power take this directive. But one thing that we can say is, and I think you're right about this, Mark, there's no independent substance in the order about exactly what policies the executive has in mind.
And no enforcement mechanism, as far as I can tell.
And no enforcement mechanism yet, right? These are all to be developed. We'll have to stand by and see what it is that comes out eventually, if anything comes out. Perhaps this will be abandoned altogether.
Yeah, I'm skeptical. But so look, to return to our thread, as I say, I think as a political matter, and I think the Trump executive order shows this, the feds are unlikely to condition the grant of funds on a college's agreement to allow certain speech, for example, you know, so-called religious hate speech, or for that matter, to demand that a university prohibit such speech.
Yeah, you and I may have slightly different perspectives. I'm not sure differ may be putting it strongly, but it is true that this has happened before. So conditioning Title IX federal funding as a basis for demanding campus speech codes was happening in the Obama administration. Those codes prohibited students from speaking in ways defined by the government as unwelcome, as sexual in nature. Now, granted, those codes relate to sexual matters.
Right, that's what I was going to say.
But they don't relate to religious matters. However, that is a kind of intrusion. It's an intrusion that it seems to be going, in fact, the other way. That is to say, that is restricting further what colleges and universities and people in them, students and faculty, can say, as opposed to the direction that the Trump order seems to be going, which to be encouraging more speech, right? It seems to want to say, in order to advance or promote the ends of free inquiry, we ought to allow more speakers That is to say, private universities ought to allow more speakers on campus.
Yeah, okay. Well, you and I think we have a little disagreement about how likely that is. But even if I'm right that the federal government is not likely to do this, it is true that some state governments might try to do so to the extent they provide funds. I mean, states are much more monolithically, state governments are often much more monolithically on one side than bipartisan. And so they might try to do something like this. But if a government did try to condition its grant of funding in that way, it seems to me it would likely violate the unconstitutional conditions doctrine that I've talked about. So the unconstitutional conditions doctrine works like this. It says that if the state gives money to a private institution, the state can attach quote-unquote reasonable conditions to that financial assistance, because after all, the colleges are free to reject that financial assistance, so it really is not forcing them to do anything. And the important case here is a case called Grove City College from the 1980s, which involved Title IX.
And I should add, in response to that case, a number of colleges, including Grove City College, have divested themselves entirely. They are not receiving federal funds at all, even to the point of, because this is what the Grove City College case was about, even to the point of loans, student loans, mm-hmm. Granted by the federal government. You can't accept those either. And so a number of schools, Hillsdale, I believe, is one. Grove City is another. Mm-hmm. Patrick Henry College.
Christendom College.
Exactly right. So they do exist. It's, as you say, it's very difficult. It's very expensive to do this. But in response to the Grove City College case, some colleges have.
Right. Okay. So the government is allowed to attach reasonable conditions. The government is allowed to attach reasonable conditions to financial assistance. But under the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, the government can't impose conditions on funding that would infringe a constitutional right like free speech or like freedom of association. And so, to my mind, that would make it very difficult for the government to condition funds on requiring a university to allow certain kinds of speech or certain kinds of speakers. Now, it's true, everything's going to turn on whether the condition is reasonable or not under this doctrine.
I'll put it to you this way. It would be much more of an open question if you had speakers involved as opposed to speech involved. In other words, it would be seemingly a much more direct violation of the unconstitutional conditions doctrine if the government is actually demanding that certain kinds of viewpoints or ideas be voiced. Whether that is true also for speakers, it probably is in many circumstances, but it at least seems to me a less clear question than speech itself.
I don't know. I think as presently constituted, it seems to me very unlikely that the court would think it's a reasonable condition to federal funding that a school allow certain speech or speakers on campus. So if a school wanted to ban quote-unquote religious hate speech, I think the school could, even if it took federal funds. But there is this case out there called Fair versus Rumsfeld, Mark, and I think we should tell our readers about that case because that case might point in a different direction.
Yeah, so that case involved a statute called the Solomon Amendment, and what that amendment said, this was an amendment passed in response to many private universities, their own respective reaction to the United States military's position, what was their position at the time, on LGBT people in the military.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Don't ask, don't tell, right? So that was the policy, and many private universities didn't like that policy, and as a result, excluded military recruiters. Actually, it was law schools that did this, excluded military recruiters from the general pool of recruiters that could use their facilities and that were invited to interact with their students.
Yeah, and the government said, if you want our funding, you have to allow the military recruiters on campus. And the Supreme Court, I think this was a unanimous opinion, actually.
It was 8-0.
8-0, said that Congress could condition federal funds on the school's willingness to allow military recruiters on campus. But that was because the court said that allowing the military on campus wouldn't interfere with the law school's own speech rights and rights of association, and that there would be only a trivial burden in any case. And I'm not sure that the reasoning of that case would also cover a more general rule about what speech you must allow on campus, as opposed to just the military recruiters.
That's true, although it does seem, at least in part, even Fair versus Rumsfeld seems to involve a certain kind of substance, right? Mm-hmm. The substance of allowing military on campus, right? And certainly it was the position of the law schools at the time that this was an interference with their free speech rights, a position that was rejected by the court. So So it might be, again, I'm not advocating one way or another, but just simply as a predictive and doctrinal matter, there may be ways for a government that is interested in intervening to latch on to Fair versus Rumsfeld.
Well, and especially the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions allows the justices a great deal of discretion. I mean, it says reasonable conditions, and what qualifies as a reasonable condition is going to depend a lot on the prior commitments of the judges.
It's a classic what we call weasel word, right? Yeah. It's a word that is subject to all kinds of different sorts of interpretation depending on what one believes is reasonable or not.
Okay, so I think that's the legal landscape here, Mark. But I think we'd also like to talk in this podcast a little bit about, how might you put it, extra legal restrictions on freedom of speech, or restrictions that come, social pressures, things like that.
Yeah, I think that's right. So it's not just the legal landscape, which we've covered, I think, but the consequences, the sort of social and cultural consequences. So we might imagine, you know, suppose a private university just refuses to invite any conservative speakers to campus. It would be one thing if the school actually had a policy stating so, right? Just stating, look, we're not interested in open inquiry here. Mm-hmm. We're interested in only hosting speakers that have the correct point of view. That maybe might be a clearer case where the government might have grounds to intervene, right? Schools actively and explicitly suppressing speech.
Yeah. So again, we have another difference here, listeners. I don't think the government would have legal grounds to intervene, even in a case as extreme as Mark is putting it.
Well, I mean, all right, maybe not. But look, even that is not the case for most schools, right? Most schools do not have policies that say, look, what we really would like to do is to suppress certain viewpoints and have only the good and true viewpoints, right? So compliance with written policies is not really the problem that we have, to the extent that we think that it is a problem. If anybody thinks that there's a problem, it's not a question of official policy. It seems to me, at least, and maybe, Mark, I'm curious to know what you think, this is more about the culture that implements these policies.
Okay, so we are really trying to shift gears here, because we, legally speaking, if we put aside the hypothetical Mark just gave us that I disagree with, private universities basically have free rein, legally speaking, with respect to the kind of speech we're discussing. And so now we'd like to think about, well, is that a good thing? I mean, you know, maybe even voluntary associations like private universities can really impinge on expression. In other words, you know, maybe compliance with written policies, as you say, isn't really the problem here.
Right. I mean, even if a university beefs up its official code in response to some perceived threat of funding withdrawal by the government, that's very unlikely to address the underlying problems in situations like the one that we were talking about, the disinvitation at Middlebury of Richard Legutko, or many of the similar recent episodes of universities restricting free speech and inquiry in the name of student safety or some other kind of competing value. And that may be a situation where the law, at least, is going to have a hard time correcting the problems. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean, as you say, that the problems are any less real. Universities are supposed to be, in the first instance, and as a matter of their basic commitments, devoted to free speech and free inquiry, to a breadth of ideological and academic perspectives, and to the freedom of faculty and students to express those views. And it also doesn't mean that the law couldn't change. It could certainly change or take a different direction. Even Title IX cases like Grove City College interpreting it, those marked a major change in the absolute independence of private universities that accept federal money. And it might be that the problems of speech and open inquiry on campus get so bad somehow that the government, federal or state, feels like it needs to take action.
I guess so, Mark, but I wonder, what is the real problem here? And this gets us away into our exchange with Damon Linker, who writes for The Week. We had an exchange on Twitter a while ago about whether these are really problems with regard to suppression of speech. I mean, it might be the case that certain kinds of speech, certain kinds of expression just turn out not to be terribly popular in particular communities. And, you know, private institutions, which can be devoted to a certain view of the good, can say, we just don't want to hear those things here. So what would be the problem with something like that?
Well, this was Damon's position was the one that you're expressing. He said these controversies on campus, of course, the kinds that we've been discussing, but throughout public and private life more broadly, in the employment context, in one's business, you know, these very prominent cases about, you know, like Masterpiece Cake Shop and so on that we've discussed in prior podcasts, they're not really about, in social media, that's another one that seems to be coming up frequently, they're not about the First Amendment. They're not really about a threat to speech in that kind of way. And I think technically he's actually correct about that. What we've talked about seems to back up his position, but there might be a deeper point that may be missing in saying, as he does, that therefore there is no speech crisis in the United States today.
So I think what you're saying, Mark, is that, and it's a powerful point, I think we need to address it, which is, you know, giving private institutions like colleges and universities more or less free rein to decide what kinds of speech is allowed and what isn't, well, you might say that's a good thing for free speech because then people have associational freedom and they can decide what ideas they want to express and what ideas they want to associate themselves with. On the other hand, as these institutions become increasingly powerful, then they themselves might be engines for suppressing speech, even though the government isn't involved at all. I think that's what you're getting at.
I think that's right. So the question is, it could be put in the form of a question, is the only thing that we have to fear the government?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that question might be, well, no, the government is something that we ought to be, that we ought to fear, that we ought to be interested in controlling. But it's not the only thing, the only social, cultural pressure that we need to be mindful of or that we need to keep watch over.
Right. So, I mean, one thing you might say is if you're a faculty member and, you know, you lose your job because you're expressing ideas that, and this could happen. We have a recent case just apparently just Duke University this week involving someone in their public policy school. I mean, I don't know. He's alleging that's why they fired him. We'd have to look at the actual facts. But, you know, if you lose your job because you expressed a viewpoint that is not approved, it's not going to really console you that, after all, it wasn't the government. It was just your employer who put you out of work.
Yeah, and there's another point here, too, Mark, that we might think about, which is, and I think you and I have both written about this, law tends to be a lagging indicator. So law tends to be responsive to social and cultural change, social and cultural conditions. And so a strong free speech culture will result in a strong set of legal protections for free speech. If the social institutions and cultural institutions that we're talking about, if their commitment to free speech and free inquiry diminishes, then we should expect that over time the law will reflect those commitments as well.
Yeah.
So that these are connected factors. They're not totally distinct from one another. And so even though I think, as I say, I think Damon is technically correct to point out this difference, they are related.
Well, and there's also maybe a truth in advertising claim because, and this maybe the Trump executive order is getting at this, if you advertise yourself as a place open to free inquiry and then you shut down viewpoints that oppose prevailing orthodoxy, well, then you've kind of been dishonest about things.
Yeah, I think that it's certainly true. This is why I think we were right to focus on universities in some sense, because as cultural institutions, they are, at least historically, they have been one of the chief sponsors of objectives, aims like free inquiry, open debate, free speech.
Well, recent history. I mean, if you think
recent
back to
history.
Right, earlier universities, they would have been quite comfortable with saying, if you want to teach here, if you want to, you can't express things that depart from, well, it would have been prevailing Christian orthodoxy at the time.
I think so. So maybe it might be that we're returning, or returning in some sense, to an earlier vision of the university, one that was dominant before, say, the 19th century German model of the university,
right,
that was imported here. Well, look, all of this to say that where cultural authorities draw the line, how aggressively they draw it, with what social injuries they can inflict, all of that will certainly affect the sort of society that people live in and how they experience either freedom or repression in their own lives.
Well, and as you say, there might be a feedback also, because these kinds of cultural commitments will inform what counts as a reasonable condition or not under the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. So, okay, that'll be it for this broadcast, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. We encourage you to listen to past editions of Legal Spirits. They're available on iTunes and also at our website, lawandreligionforum.org. That's one word, lawandreligionforum.org. Until then, this has been Mark Movsesian, the director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's, with my colleague, Mark DiGirolami, the center's associate director. Look forward to next time.